TFM.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, I gotta say, you're looking pretty sharp in Command Red today.
Well, Chris, I just decided that it's time to take, literally a new track with my career, and leading is where I'm feeling led to go. And I'm really excited. And I've got to say, I really do feel like the red looks good on me. It's much better for my complexion than the mustard yellow.
Yeah, I would agree. It looks really sharp. And so you're feeling led to lead today. All right. Well, this is a lead in to what we're going to talk about here in a two-part orb. We're going to talk about The Way of the Warrior, the premiere of season four of Deep Space Nine. Here's a quick intro to the story, which will serve for both episodes of our discussion. Following the revelation that the Founders had infiltrated the Alpha Quadrant, tensions are high and Starfleet is preparing for the worst. Those tensions rise when the Klingons arrive at Deep Space Nine on a mission, allegedly to support their Federation allies. But as trouble begins to brew, Sisko brings Worf to the station to help smooth things over and find out what is really going on. Once the Klingons' plans to invade Cardassia are revealed, the relations between the Federation and the Empire quickly deteriorates and the peace treaty is dissolved. And kind of all hell breaks loose after that. And of course, this story is about much more, Matthew, than just this tension between the Federation and the Klingon Empire. Got a lot going on here, especially a lot of character stuff with Worf. But just to start off, why don't we go high level and talk about the shift in the series? Because when we think about The Way of the Warrior, I think most people think first about the addition of Worf. Then they think about the subtraction of Sisko's hair.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of other stuff that happens here that kind of sends the series in a new direction. So it becomes the show that we think of when we say DS9.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, and obviously, I think anybody who's listening to this show knows that they were kind of given a mandate to bring Worf onto the show for season four, and that was going to change the direction. This show specifically had been moving from the end of season three into season four. Their thought process was, okay, we're going to go with the Dominion, and they have to do kind of an abrupt left to actually get to the Dominion and bring Worf onto the station and find a reason for him to be there. And so, I think it is a really interesting curveball that they get thrown. And in all honesty, I think that they handle it really well because they find a way to make it work in the story that they're trying to tell. At the same time, use it to bring Worf to the station. And the most interesting thing to me is that this shift in the series mirrors our original introduction to Deep Space Nine in the fact that the character coming to Deep Space Nine that we're focusing on here the most in season four, their introduction is Worf, but he's much like Sisko when he comes to Deep Space Nine. He's kind of a broken man. He's a broken Kling man. And he's
a Klingman.
A Klingman.
Is that like a Klingon?
Yes, yes.
A Klingman?
Okay. And he's wrestling with the loss of the Enterprise. At this point, you know, generations that happened, the Enterprise D has been destroyed. You know, his home is gone, and his life in Starfleet, he's questioning all of it. You know, does he want to pursue something else? And the difficulty here, again, of reintroducing the Klingons and Worf and everything, he's again being forced to choose a side between his two heritages, you know, the people who raised him on Earth and his adopted home of Earth, and of course Starfleet, and the Klingon people. And so I think it's a really interesting shift in the series. But what I think the smartest thing that they do is they mirror their original first season and their original problem with the captain and with Worf. And what it helps do is it helps bring that character into the show, and at the same time, make it feel like you get an opportunity then to show how much everybody else on Deep Space Nine has grown over the last 3 years by kind of using Worf as like a sounding board for all of these characters.
Mm-hmm. And I think that is quite evident in his interactions with O'Brien, because they were both on the Enterprise, and we know them from the Next Generation. So we see all that growth in O'Brien and how much more comfortable I think he seems in his own skin, especially in those interactions with Bashir, where we see them talking about things. So yeah, it's a great point about mirroring emissary. And interestingly, it's a point that I haven't thought a lot about, even though it is right there at the surface. I mean, it's quite clear. And they do have the discussion, certainly, when Worf starts talking about considering resigning from Starfleet. There are a number of scenes in the overall episode, the 2-hour episode, where Sisko explains these things to Worf and is mirroring his own situation with Worf's. But from a creative standpoint, from a storytelling standpoint, yeah, it's quite interesting to almost halfway through the series to return to that original premise.
I wanted to ask you, with the shift in the series, like just kind of thinking back, how did you feel about that? Like, because this is a major change. But like you said, in many ways, I think a lot of people, when they think of Deep Space Nine, they do kind of think of season 4 onwards. Because not only do we change the fact that Worf's there, Sisko finally gets to lose the hair, we change the theme too.
Yeah. The theme was interesting because especially at this time, when this first aired, I had just finished university and, you know, I have a degree in music and I'm actually a professional classical musician. I play bass trombone. And the change in the theme, one of the big changes was the addition of this driving bass line, which of course I loved. One thing that I love, just to talk about the music for a minute, one thing that I love about the change in the music and how it ties into the change in the series itself, into the story, is that it doesn't fit together. Like, we've seen them pep up music on other shows before. Of course, Enterprise did the same thing. You know, Enterprise went to kind of faster rock ballad thing as well. But if you listen to the original version of the DS9 theme, the melody that's going through there, and then the bass line that they put underneath, they don't quite fit together. There's like this fighting going on musically. There's it's not dissonance in the sense of chords being dissonant, but it's like a dissonance in the sense of not neatly fitting together. And I just think that so perfectly sums up Deep Space Nine itself, and especially the story from this point to the end of the series. There's always this little bit of uneasiness, this little bit of conflict, and this tension that's going. And I just think that the theme, the change in the theme, fits that perfectly. Now, at the time, I didn't like it. I thought, like, why are they doing this? You know, I like the original theme. I love the original theme. Do we really need to do this? But over the years, I've come to really appreciate the change, and I do much prefer the peppier theme over the original.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that you mentioned the whole idea of there, you know, that there's tension in it, because I think that mm-hmm. is really what it means. The music, it really does help you relate to the actual tension that we have in the show. And mm-hmm. there is always a lot of tension in Deep Space Nine. And I think the beauty of the shift in the series is that we get to actually dive into that even more. And in a lot of ways, even just throwing in the wrench, you know, the Worf, throwing in the Worf of to things, yeah. is something that they take something that I think could completely derail any other show, and they really make it work here, and they use it to their full advantage to tell a story that's even more nuanced than maybe the story they were planning on telling. And I think that's kind of the beauty of getting the shift, the series here. And we all think of that shift fondly now instead of like, oh man, that's when Deep Space Nine went downhill.
Oh, yeah, yeah, right. Well, yeah, they were able to, we'll talk about it in a little while, but originally they were planning to go with Changelings on Earth mm-hmm. as the season four storyline, at least at the beginning, because we get that revelation at the end of season three. And they did have to shift gears like this, but they still managed to tell that story anyway while bringing in Worf and making the transition and bringing in the Klingons and just the deftness of the writing, the skill of the writing and pulling all that together is very impressive. I want to make one more point before we leave music, because sometimes we get asked this, and I don't think we've ever talked about this on the podcast. I'm talking about how the original melody and the additional bass line all don't quite fit together. It's almost like they're two different pieces. Even the rhythm, it doesn't fit so well. The theme music to this podcast, what people may not know, is I overlaid two completely separate pieces of music to do the theme music to this podcast. It's the introduction to The Way of the Warrior, the very first music you hear when The Way of the Warrior starts, and the theme to DS9. They're two different compositions, and at one point I laid them over the top of each other. That's why you hear all this kind of strange dissonance going on when you listen to the beginning of this podcast.
Yeah,
just a musical point there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it captures the mood of the show quite well. Mm-hmm. Okay, so talking about Worf, let's talk about welcoming Worf, because you asked me a moment ago how I felt at the time about the shifts in the show, and this is part of that. And I'm one of the people that when I found out that Worf was coming to Deep Space Nine, I was not happy about it. I thought, oh man, this sounds like a stunt. You know, they say the ratings are falling. They want to do something. They want to bring the TNG fans over to DS9. And I think that is part of what they were doing. They wanted to bring the TNG fans and the Klingon fans over. But I just thought, you know, Worf is a next generation character. To me, he's TNG. I like the DS9 characters that we have. I don't think we need to bring him in. I don't think this is going to be good for the show. Those are my thoughts in the moment as it was happening, as the news was being reported. But of course, anyone listening to the show knows how I feel today about Worf being on DS9. And I think it was the best move ever for the character and also a great move for the show. But how did you feel that? Maybe we talked about this years and years ago on here when we talked mm-hmm. about Worf, but I don't remember now. How did you feel when you found out Worf was going to be coming over?
I don't think I remember having an issue with it. If there was anything, you know, just kind of wondering how he would fit. But in many ways, I don't think that there is a better fit for Deep Space Nine than Worf as a character, because of the fact that he's more of a brooding type, and that fits perfectly with what we have here on Deep Space Nine. It's a bunch of people who are, you know, trying to figure out their lives and aren't necessarily the life of the party. And in many ways, I think it just feels more realistic as a show, you know, where it's not all of these completely outgoing characters all the time, you know, and so I think for me, bringing in Worf was a really smart move. And what I think, rewatching the episode, what I was really shocked by, again, I think, is just how well Worf meshes immediately with all of the characters and all of the actors. So he feels like he's been there the whole time, really. I mean, and just case in point, I think we've talked about before, but I think his interaction with Bashir and O'Brien at the bar, and then, of course, Kira and Dax come down. They've just been in the holodeck. That whole interaction there is fantastic. All of the chemistry is working between the actors in different ways, but they all they have a good chemistry together. And then, of course, immediately Terry Farrell and Michael Dorn have chemistry together. Just, I mean, they're almost like rewatching. I was amazed just to see the way their characters kind of felt like they were already making eyes at one another. Like, and so the beauty of this is that they get this forced on them, but it works.
Yeah.
And it works because of the actors. It works because of the writing. And I think it works because they got lucky, because Michael Dorn might not have meshed with the Deep Space Nine people, but he did. And I think everyone here just makes the absolute most of it as a way to further their own character development to be able to play off this new character. And that's great.
Yeah, he meshes wonderfully. I think it helps a lot that his character was so well established already, and he had been playing that character for so long. So for him to walk into that setting and to be playing a Starfleet officer, Klingon, in that situation was already very natural for him. I mean, he's not trying to find a character, so that helped a lot. And then the fact that this is the start of season four, and of course, we're not talking about these really short 10-episode seasons that we have on TV shows these days where you say, you know, it's season four now. And I'm thinking, okay, but you know, you've only done four more episodes than one season in the past. So it's not really like you've settled into your character the way that past TV shows had. In this situation, everyone had been playing their characters for so long that they were all very comfortable. And so, yeah, it was a great environment. And the fact that they had already established that Jadzia's previous host had been involved with Klingons, and therefore Jadzia already had this connection to Klingons, I think that helped a lot to make that connection work. And if Jadzia's character had not had that element, perhaps Worf coming on the station would not have meshed quite as easily with the crew. Because also Sisko, through his relationship with Curzon, also has a bit more of an understanding or an affinity to Klingons than other Starfleet captains that we've seen in the past. And so, you know, that helped a lot.
No, I completely agree with that. And I'm really glad that you brought that up, because it's almost as though they had, it's almost like they had known, you know, like, but they didn't. And again, it's one of those places where it does become kind of a felicitous thing, in the sense that they had already created those story points, like you said. We've already spent so much time with all of these characters, and then you bring in another character that we've all spent so much time with, and he does mesh well with everyone. And so I think it just, it creates the perfect storm of wonderfulness.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, I think one of the beauties of the thing about this episode is that we give Worf probably the same amount, if not more, of character development in this one two-part episode that he got in all of TNG, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I'm sure for Michael Dorn as an actor was a very attractive proposition, especially once he realized that they were going to be developing the character. You know, it's a different kind of TV show. So it's not so much a fault of TNG that the characters are not very developed. That's just the type of storytelling on that show. And here you get more of a shift. The thing about the character development and all, and me talking about how I felt about the news that Worf was going to come on, is that at that point in my life, as a viewer, I was not as interested or concerned about character development like I am now, and as I have been, you know, all the decade that we've been doing this show together. So at that point in time, the prospect of Worf's character being explored and richly developed wasn't something that I was really thinking about or considering. But then as the show went on, you know, I started to care about those things more, and then I also started to see what they were doing. The other thing, while we're talking about characters, we might want to return to this later on, but the fact that they could bring Worf onto the show, a show that already has a full main cast and already has all of these other characters who we're getting to know, and we see a lot of them in this story, Garak, Dukat, and they introduce more in this story. Bartok, who we'll talk about, they bring Gowron back in. There's so much stuff going on, and yet you don't feel like any of the characters are getting shortchanged. We learn new things about Bashir and O'Brien and Kira and mm-hmm. Dax and yeah. Quark and Dukat and everyone. We keep learning new things in this episode while they're still fully properly introducing and servicing an additional character as part of the main cast. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I do think that one of the reasons that's a possibility, and I think we've touched on this before, but I do think it bears repeating, is the fact that, well, it works because these people have more time to develop these characters because
right. yeah.
they have 20 some odd episodes a season. And so you do not have to rush that, and you can build up all of these different characters. And that's where I think a lot of times many shows these days, because they only have maybe 6 to 10 episodes a season, unless it's really focused mm-hmm. on just a few characters, you kind of run into the problem of, well, people get shortchanged or story points for them feel like they go too fast, or you don't really know enough about them. And that, again, bringing in Worf, we mentioned he's had 7 seasons on a show, and these other characters have all had 3 seasons of a show already, but they're like twice the length of seasons today. And that really does help you feel much more comfortable, but it also just gives you more time for development in the first place. So, yeah, mm-hmm. Again, it's one of those things where I think it all works so well to their benefit to be able to do this.
Yeah, definitely. So while we're talking about Worf, we're talking about Klingons, let's talk about one of the other big shifts in the series here, which is bringing back the Klingons. They had a mandate to bring Worf back, but what they really had a mandate for was to do something to shake up the show, because the studio is looking at the ratings and they feel like, oh, the ratings are falling and we need to do something that's different. Maybe DS9 is too slow for most Star Trek fans. It's not connecting this way. You know, we know in reality there are many reasons why the ratings were sliding, and Ira talks about that a bit in the documentary that came out recently. But anyway, they had a mandate to do something to shake up the show, and their first thought was apparently to have the Vulcans leave the Federation. Because, oh my God, the Vulcans, one of the founding members of the Federation, they're going to leave, and that's going to create some kind of tension and excitement and really shake things up. Of course, the reality is the Vulcans as a race have never been a big part of Star Trek at this point. We've had Spock, and the Next Generation avoided Vulcans as much as possible for the first half of the series. And then we did get unification, but the Vulcans were never a big part of the Star Trek story. And then Deep Space Nine made an effort to use Vulcans, but still they were just there as, you know, admirals or members of, you know, Federation officers who we see, such as that. So I don't think personally that having the Vulcans leave the Federation would have really shaken up the series or opened the door to the kind of bigger storytelling mm-hmm. that they really needed for the series and to create yeah. the masterpiece that DS9 became that we all love.
I think you're absolutely right in that this cracks open the storytelling for them in the sense of what they were going to do with the Dominion, where they're going for that. And this actually, I think...
Bringing in the Klingons.
Yeah, this, right. Whole part of the left turn actually allows them to accentuate just how dangerous the Dominion is. And I think it really works, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. But I think an even bigger part of that is if you look at Star Trek overall, and, you know, Star Trek, it needs to evolve with the times. And we're seeing that today with the series, whether you're a fan of the series or not, like Discovery, it is a case of Star Trek evolving with the times and the types of stories that it's telling. And so that's been true throughout Star Trek's history. And at this point in time, we had come out of the Next Generation where there was this idea that the Federation and the Klingon Empire had become allies. And later, during that time, the Undiscovered Country came out and we actually got a name put to that. We got the Khitomer Accords. So we found out how that came to be and why during the 24th century, the Klingons and the Federation are allies. But if you think about the storytelling in The Next Generation, the Klingons, who were the big adversaries in the original series, even though we don't actually see them that often, but we know that they're there and they show up in the movies, you kind of defanged them. Right? It's kind of like the way Voyager defangs the Borg in my eyes later on. The adversary is no longer the big threat it was before. In The Next Generation, it's like, okay, we're buddies now. We're friends. And we have a Klingon on the bridge of the Enterprise. And so Klingon storytelling for a long time became about Worf. And then it became about the Federation, Picard, helping maintain stability in the Klingon Empire. We've still got friendly relations. Is that really a good recipe for long-term storytelling? Was it a good idea to throw out the Khitomer Accords?
You know, I think bringing back the Klingons, kind of allowing them to get back to their more warrior ways is a really interesting thought. And giving them a reason to do that, to where they're fearful of the Dominion, is great. And of course, the way that's going to play out later on in the series is we're going to learn, you know, exactly who's really behind all that and what, where the big push comes from and why. But I think it's one of those places where the writers found the right buttons to push, with the right race to be pushing them with. And the Klingons already dislike the Cardassians in the first place. The Cardassians dislike the Klingons. So, you know, the founders here pick the two best races to kind of create a quick war and destabilize the Alpha and Beta quadrants very quickly. And I think that's the genius of it, is that the Deep Space Nine writers truly understand, I think, the Klingons very well. And I think, you know, as much Klingon stuff as we do get in The Next Generation, and I think that it sets the template for what we're going to do on Deep Space Nine. For Deep Space Nine, we take that and we just run with it. And we do that in a way that I think continues to deepen and strengthen that portrayal of this race. And in many ways, jumping to it, I think, by giving us Martok, who's going to become a really important member of the show in later seasons, like, he becomes this fascinating way of kind of watching, like, we've seen many warrior Klingons, right? But Martok has a nuance to him at the same time. Part of that's the way he's played by J.G. Hertzler. And part of that's obviously the writing for the character as well. But, you know, this gives us the ability to kind of peek inside the warrior cast of the Klingons and give them more nuance. And so I think bringing in the Klingons and then giving us this new character of Martok, who's going to become one of the greatest characters in Deep Space Nine by the end, is fantastic.
Well, Martok, for me, might be the greatest Klingon character in all of Star Trek, even...
I'll drink to that.
They're different. Yeah, I mean, they're different types of characters. Like, as a pure Klingon, not someone who grew up on Earth and served in Starfleet, he's definitely the greatest. And the other would be Worf, probably, because Worf became such a nuanced and very interesting character. But yeah, so let's talk about Martok's introduction to the show, because I cannot imagine DS9 playing out to the end as it does without Martok being there.
Yeah.
Without J.G. Hertzler being there playing Martok, you could say, well, there would have been a different Klingon. You could have had a different actor playing Martok. You could have had a different general instead of Martok. But maybe it would have worked. It would have been different, of course, because it would have been someone else. But there is something about Martok that broke the mold of Klingons. I'm not a huge fan of Klingons as far as the Klingon stories go. When a Klingon episode comes on, it's like, okay, I'll watch. You know, there's some that I really like, but there are a lot where I kind of get bored with them, especially Next Generation stories where the Klingons come and are the focus of an episode. And I think one reason for that is that I feel that they're just, I don't want to call them one-trick targs, but, you know, they're not as nuanced as, say, the Cardassians became on DS9. But I feel that starting with this episode, that this wonderful group of writers on DS9 was able to break that mold, and it started with Martok, and it started with Worf coming onto the show. And Martok just feels like a fully realized character in the same sense that Gul Dukat is at this point. And you didn't see that with someone like Gowron on The Next Generation. And Gowron comes back here, and he's Gowron. You know, he's your crazy Uncle Gowron that we all love, that shows up at the party with his bulging eyes and his outgoing personality. But he still serves that role that Klingons had served up to this point of, they were in the story for a specific purpose, to play against Picard. But here you've got someone who is sort of independent from Sisko or what's going on with the other parts of the story, the Starfleet story, Federation story. And even he's meeting Worf for the first time too. And we get that establishment of their relationship and the way he reacts to Worf, like Worf disarming his son and pulling him to his quarters to ask him questions. You would kind of expect with Klingons that the dynamic would be different, that Martok would look down on Worf because Worf is not a real Klingon, for example. But Hertzler, he doesn't play it that way. He plays it like, I feel like a real person, not a cardboard cutout warrior.
No, I 100% agree with you on that. And I really like that you pulled out the, you know, his portrayal when he's talking to Worf, and the just the way in which he's a no-nonsense character. You know, he doesn't put on pretense for any, like, there's no reason for him to put on pretense. He just is who he is, and, you know, he's not trying to make himself better than he, you know, should be, or, you know, he's probably more humble than he needs to be as well, especially as we get to know him later. And so, no, I 100% agree. And the strange part is that what we meet here is supposedly a changeling, even though somehow he's able to beat the blood screening.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, yeah, we should bring that up because people listening will say, but wait, that's not Martok. That's a changeling. And, you know, that's where there's like a bit of retconning in the story. At the point that he was brought in here, I don't think there was any intention that he was a changeling. But then later there's that line where we find out that, okay, well, at this point in time, Martok had been replaced. And so, yeah, maybe he's a changeling. If you watch this episode with the mindset that he's just a Klingon general, it works perfectly fine. if you watch this episode with the mindset that he's a changeling trying to influence Gowron, it also works fine. You can see it both ways, mm-hmm. and you can read things into the acting and the portrayal if you want. He does cut his hand to check to make sure that they're all people. They're not changelings, and the blood drips. But then there's that theory that, well, maybe they had found a way to beat the screenings, or maybe the changeling had hidden blood in his palm, and that's why he cut his palm. Although we do know from other stories that Klingons do that. They cut their palms. So
I don't know why people cut their hand there. Why would you do that? Like, why can't you just prick your finger and let blood come out of that?
Yeah,
like,
right?
I don't know why you have to cut your whole hand. It makes no sense.
It's more warrior-like, Matthew.
Yes, I'm sure.
You gotta be a warrior right there. So we're not gonna debate whether he is or is not a changeling in the writer's mind at the moment that they wrote this story. But we might do that on a different episode. I think it would be an interesting topic. Mm-hmm. But for the purpose of this discussion, I just think that another part of that shift was not only bringing the Klingons back in as adversaries, but bringing in one Klingon who would become an absolute key part of the leadership of the war when the Alpha Beta powers fight the Dominion through the end of the series. And I just think that Martok is one of the greatest characters in Star Trek.
I could not agree more. I love him as a character. He is legitimately one of my favorite Deep Space Nine characters, especially when you think of the menagerie of characters that we have. But he is great.
Yeah.
And by the end of the series, he just adds so much to the series as well. And especially for the characters around him. But like you said, he becomes an avatar for allowing us to see a different side of Klingons that we haven't really seen before, and to really get to explore what their lives and what they are actually like, other than just being brutish, thuggish, you know, warriors. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the things that I really do love, that they did finally take the time to flesh out the Klingons and make them a much more interesting race. And again, you know, how creativity works. This is a case where, hey, we want you to do something different with the show. We need you to shake things up. What can we do? What if we get rid of the Khitomer Accords and we bring the Klingons in and we create conflict with the Klingons? And that's a solution to a challenge that's been put before you. And yet the result of that solution that you weren't thinking about ends up delivering some of the greatest storylines and one of the greatest characters, or a couple of the greatest characters, because Worf, you know, Worf goes from being this token Klingon in Starfleet to becoming a really rich character by the end of Deep Space Nine, and that's something that we would not have foreseen. And so, yeah, you know, creative chance, sometimes it delivers amazing results.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. And, you know, I think that we touched on this a little bit, but, you know, I think that really the threat that we get here, and this really insidious threat of the fact that the changelings could be anyone, there's a heightened sense of fear on the station in the Federation, but all of these different races. And what's great is the way in which the changelings completely understanding how to throw the Alpha and Beta Quadrants out of whack very quickly, and that it's a precarious cliff that they're on. And you know, all of these different empires and federations and stuff are all kind of walking this tightrope, and they just start to wiggle the tightrope a little bit, and people start wobbling and starting to try and hold on and fall off, and it's phenomenal. And again, I think what this does is it raises the level of stakes for how scary the founders are, and we barely have seen them. But they're destabilizing everything already.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that would be a great place to start our second part of the discussion. So let's wrap up our first part here. And we would like to hear your thoughts on the Way of the Warrior and the points that we've discussed so far today. So if you'd like to do that, there are many ways you can do it. A great way is to join the Babel Conference on Facebook. That is our closed listeners group. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field, and it should come right on up. It is a closed group, so if you want to join, please answer the questions and agree to the rules so that I can let you into the forum. You can also send us email if you go to our website at trek.fm/contact and choose to send to a show and choose the orb. And that'll come to Matthew and me. And you can also find us on Twitter and everywhere in social media where our username is TrekFM. Now, Matthew, if people want to catch what you're doing, you know, when you're not running around trying to get information from Cardassian tailors and take a sip of root beer, where can people find you?
Yeah, well, of course, you could find me all over the place under MattRushing02, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero, Twitter, all of those type of places. I'm here in the network, of course, doing Literary Treks as well as Warp 5. Literary Treks is about the books and the comics of Star Trek and Warp 5. Chris, you and I are walking through all of the episodes there, which is super fun as we celebrate 20 years of Enterprise, which is insane. And, of course, you can also find me on the 602 Club talking about all of the fandoms we love outside of Star Trek. We have a whole other side of the network devoted to that. And if there are bonus shows in there, you can find as well with Snyder Cuts as well as Assembling Avengers. And then you can find me over on the Nerd Party Network. I've got a finished show called Owlpost with Drea Kaufman. We talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. And then, of course, last but not least, you could find me doing Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills there as well as we talk about Star Wars every week. But Chris, you know, if people want to catch up with you as you, you know, I don't know, maybe you're enjoying some massage holodeck programs, where can they find you?
I need that definitely right now because I actually have headaches all the time from tension. I need that. So you can find me elsewhere on the network doing, of course, as you mentioned, Warp 5 with you, sometimes Literary Treks. Larry Nemechek and I do The Ready Room from time to time, and I have other things going on as well. And if you'd like to chat with me about Star Trek or anything, you can find me on social media. My username is C. Brian Jones, a letter C and Brian with a Y. That's my username everywhere, and I'd love to chat with you there. And if you'd like to help us keep the network going and keep everything that we're doing going into 2022, we could definitely use your support through Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you can find out how to support the network and get involved. And we really thank everyone who's helping us right now. We really could not do this without you. All right, Matthew, well, let's get ready for the second part of our discussion. And just I'm just going to do a sweep beforehand and make sure there aren't any changelings around my studio.
Chris, that is a great call. And we want to thank you, everyone, for listening. And we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.